So this biology, this just makes the point that it's based in, the Schedian system is, appears to anticipate orbital mechanics. This is, for me, a personally profound point. This means you don't mess with this stuff. It goes all the way back in the origins of early complex life, and it's conserved in biology. And why is that important? Well, it's important because, and we know it's conserved across species, and nobody gives a better talk on this than Jerry Siegel. I like the fact that it's not only in all the mammals, the monotremes, the marsupials, and placentals, but the Drosophila, etc. But this is the problem, and this is a quote from other people have referred to this. So my first point is this problem right here, which is you don't need sleep, and if we could create artificial light, the very light Chuck was saying is so good at entraining us, all our problems will just go away. And that really hasn't been the case, but I can't really blame this on Tom Edison because apparently we all love doing this. This seems to be a drive of Homo sapiens. This is something we have been doing, going everywhere and using all hours of the day and night, probably very far back. The messages we send about sleep, therefore, are sometimes deceptively negative. And this was a full-page ad in the USA Today, and a couple, actually back in 2000 when the Olympics were in Australia. I'm not picking on Chevrolet, but it makes my point perfectly. I was reading it in an airplane flight across the country and folded it up and put it away in USA Today, and I kept thinking there's something not right about that paper. And I pulled it back up and opened it again and said, what's wrong with this picture? Well, I would argue this is a prepubescent girl. Chevrolet's proud to bring you Olympic moments like this. Here are the ice skates. You can't see it. It's 3:53. I don't think that's in the afternoon. What's the message? Get a prepubescent child up at 4 o'clock in the morning so she can practice ice skating to be an Olympic champion. There it is. I think that pretty much captures the culture. So we are the enemy, as Pogo said. We have met us, and we are it. The problem here is we then build these extremely large, highly lethal systems. When automation came online in the 70s, we built these mega tankers and we built larger and larger airplanes. And then we dropped sulfuric acid and airplanes and bodies and oil and everything else all over the place all the time. The media doesn't really cover this much. They cover the accidents, but the first rule in media is morals. First, you look for the moral reason, what bad person did it. Then management, you fire all the bosses, all right? You know, you don't go after the workers, fire the bosses, because management makes everything happen in America. And then, then finally, motivation. Somebody didn't care. But nobody says biology. Nobody asks about biology. And yet, in every one of these, there are very specific causes associated with a captain who was flying 3 hours after his normal bedtime, stressed out of his mind. He put his airplane down in Little Rock in a severe storm. The only problem is he forgot to set the flaps in doing it, and he couldn't stop that aircraft, and it went off the runway and hit the light stanchions. So, and this guy, you know, the third mate's up for a long period of time. The first and second mates are in bed because they've been up 24 to 36 hours loading out of Valdez. All he has to do is turn that vessel a beam of the Busby Island light, and he's too slow to do it. Nobody knows why, and he can't explain it, and boom, they run it aground. And the same way, this guy tried to beat traffic in Philadelphia, comes through the city at 4 in the morning, falls asleep, dumps his sulfuric acid load, and closes down the busiest highway in North America for 24 hours. What do you think that cost? This stuff's going on all the time, all the time. This guy had apnea, untreated, is falling asleep with passengers on board. It was his last run as a bus driver after 40 years. And he's following the shoulder rumble strips on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and every time he hits him, he pulls back on the road, and we know that because the witnesses who survived said that's what he was doing, falling asleep. The trouble is, on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, the shoulder rumble strips peel off with these peel-off areas for truckers to sleep, and he followed them right off into the rear end of an 18-wheeler. Okay, and he lost his life. This guy went gambling all night. He was supposed to drive a bus the next day, and he gambled all night in a casino and then fell asleep and ran it down a cliff. Most of you probably don't realize that Staten Island Ferry was a guy addicted to hypnotics and hadn't slept the night before and got into the pilot house and fell asleep before he hit the barge at full speed. And so this stuff's going on all the time, but nobody likes to cover it because how does the media... This one is particularly horrific. A barge that knocked out the base of a bridge in Oklahoma, and 14 cars and trucks kept going over the end of this thing, couldn't see that it was gone before they were able to stop the flow of traffic. This stuff is all the time, everywhere, and it's biology. manifesting in wakefulness. So the question is, well, what happens here? How do you understand this? Well, we spend a lot of time sleep-depriving people in experiments. This is going to be my second point. When you do that and you measure cognitive functioning, the one thing that becomes conspicuously clear very early and gets increasingly more problematic, that is, manifests itself, is something I call wake state instability. The brain cannot sustain attention to much of anything. Now, it also slows down cognitively there, but since so much of cognition is built on attention and memory, because if you don't have either one, you don't have any behavior that's worth a darn, okay? You basically got to sit in a room with the doors locked because you're not safe. So what happens is this seems to destabilize wake mechanisms in the brain. And we measure it using a simple task. We just pay attention to something and press a button for 10 minutes. We call it the psychomotor vigilance task. But when you are alert, even if you're bored and tired of being in this laboratory where we keep you and measure you, you don't have any lapses or long reaction times. So we give you sleep, no problem. But as soon as we keep you awake at night, up they go. And what you should see in here is a circadian component, the very one that Dr. Sizer just talked about, interacting with a homeostatic drive as you go another night without sleep. So the irony here is, and this is why it's so hard to make laws about sleep and work and rest that are consistent with the biology. It's a nonlinear system. It's an oscillator interacting with a quasi-linear system. So you're actually more alert after being awake 40 hours than you were at 24 hours. This is the problem. And it's a big problem because it's very hard to write a regulation that'll fit that. We measure it with this task, as I said. Here's what you see when you do this task. If you look at all the reaction time distributions for hundreds and hundreds of trials and hundreds of subjects, when you're fully alert, they're all around a quarter of a second is the peak and a visual reaction time, and then they have this tail. And this is 1 second here, and then it goes all the way out to 30,000 or 30 seconds. And one night without sleep looks like this, and two nights like this, and three nights like this. This whole curve shifting, and out here, amalgamated into this spike, things are getting worse and worse. There's more and more sleep onsets occurring in wakefulness. Now, these are not, let me talk about the extreme ones, all the way over here at the wall at 30 seconds. This is where the person falls asleep on console. Head and everything goes, the motor system goes, they're out. And they don't recover, so an alarm goes off. Those are very rare events. But when you're alert, you don't ever have any of them. As soon as I start putting sleep pressure on you, you see what happens here. People start to have these catastrophic events. Now, you don't need to fall asleep for 30 seconds to die. 2 seconds will do it on the highway. 2 seconds at 60 miles an hour and a 4-degree angle of drift for a fall asleep crash will put you 100% out of lane in a United States highway lane. 4 seconds will put you completely off the road. So you don't need a great deal here. Now, let me show you what this looks like, though. It's been very tough in the sleep field to measure this because people want to use EEG and other techniques, but the time base is often in seconds. And what in fact is multiple seconds, 10, 30, 40, 50 seconds. This stuff is occurring much shorter than that. This is reaction times displayed as heartbeats. They're not heartbeats. It's a gimmick. It's just reaction times. Just showing you how stable reaction times are. The shorter the beat, the faster the reaction time. This is an alert subject. It's like a stable heartbeat. The brain may be bored, but it could do this task. All the reaction times are shifted low below half a second. As soon as we put sleep pressure on you, as soon as we put some sleep pressure on you, take it away for a night, we can start to see this. It starts off fine. This is why you ask somebody, aren't you tired? And they say, no, I'm good to go. And then, where's the brain? Eyes are open, you're holding the switch, where are you? And this just continues this way. So when you look at raw data, you see an alert person stable on this, but a sleepy person is unbelievably unpredictable, and there are periods not in between these long lapses where they try harder. They try so hard, they start pressing the button when nothing's there. That's compensatory effort. It's errors of commission. So we have millions of people walking around like this. Patients untreated, sleep-deprived people, people undersleeping, just walking around. And we're so used to it, and we use so much stimulant and caffeine and social stimulation that the generation coming, if they fall asleep in class and you challenge them, they say, that's your fault, my fault. I wasn't interesting enough. In other words, from their standpoint, they don't have any biological responsibility for their alertness. Make it interesting and I'll stay alert. I'll stay awake. it's not interesting, I'm not going to stay awake. So I think we're losing. Boredom is about to die because it's going away, because people just fall asleep. This is my driving accident point. Here's the paper we published in 2003 up here, and then the Walter Reed group did a similar experiment. We did 4, 6, and 8 hours a night, time in bed, and you lived in the lab for 20 days, 14 of those nights on dose of sleep. This is intent to treat, and the sleep amounts are fairly close to these amounts. But you see that the less sleep I give you, the more lapsing accumulates. These are daily averages. Within a week, the 4 and 6 hours are up into the zone of 40 hours without sleep, and they progress up to very severe levels. And here's the Walter Reed study. They did it half as long, but they did the odd numbers. This was deliberate. We just arranged it with them that we do ours that way. And they show the same thing. This is clearly a dose-dependent system. It accumulates within an individual. It gets progressively worse. And the remarkable thing is that these 30-second sleep attacks also started to show up, but only after about a week. And only about 25% of the subjects in the 6-hour condition had them, but about half the subjects in the 4-hour had them. This is nasty stuff. Now, the nonlinear mixed model regressions used for this allowed us to calculate the coefficients of change in nearly all the performance measures. They were linear as the dose of sleep dropped. What is remarkable is all of the subjective scales showed very shallow thetas. In other words, when we did this to people, they initially said, oh yeah, I'm tired. But that was it. As the days went by, they said, I've adapted. No more change. I'm not getting worse. When in fact, they're getting much worse. So there is this kind of response bias. You know, in psychometrics, the brain has no way to know what reality is. That's why if you wonder, somebody gets severe pain or severe depression or severe sleepiness, when they live with it for a while, that resets the psychometric. That's normal now. What do you mean I'm depressed? Okay, I'm not depressed. I'm not sleepy. So there's this inability to sort of introspect this with clarity. It's only after you change it with a stimulant, with CPAP, people tend to say, I feel much better. I realize now that I wasn't very good. When you do imaging, Sean Drummond did a study on this. This is actually from Sean's study published in Sleep. One of the surprises was during lapses, the default mode network in the brain, which Reichel has written about, seems to light up. So it's almost like a clutch slipping, and we don't know the connection between the sleep-wake mechanisms and the default mode network, but this is network. But that has shown up now in a couple more studies, and Mike Chee's working on this with us. But there's much more to do here to understand where these slips come from. Cliff Sapers offered us one operational model that you might apply. Cliff hasn't applied it, but I've tried to. He talks about instability of the sleep switch, and I talk about instability of wakefulness. Is it possible these lapses are momentary periods of the sleep switch turning on? It's unstable, so it turns on. When it does it, it inhibits these monoaminergic nuclei, and that in turn withdraws this wake drive to the cortex. Maybe that's through catecholamine neurons through the basal forebrain. I mean, there are a lot of possible candidates for this. We don't yet know where that is or how it works, but this is ripe for continued investigation. I want to end on my third point and the last one. Despite me telling you that people get very sleepy, very impaired, they make mistakes, there are all sorts of neurobehavioral consequences to that, and I haven't talked about countermeasures, there are enormous inter-individual differences. There is a huge proportionality between the mean and the variance in data, and when nature shows you that, that is a big warning sign. It says that when you sleep-deprive people, some of them are having a catastrophic response and some are having no response. And so what we started doing as we saw this, rather than define it away or just keep showing means, which is a little dishonest, we asked ourselves, well, where is that variance coming from? Is it stable? So here's a picture of what that variance looks like. All I've done is look at people, their lapse rates across 40 hours of wakefulness, one night without sleep, and I threw out the 60% in the middle and kept the 20% who had little to no response, their means, and a 20% that had a type 3 or severe response, their means. So notice that their differences here are magnified markedly here. Here are their self-ratings. Once again, those are of zero use. Okay, and this is, I mean, you know, as a psychologist who studies the biological basis of behavior, I can assure you nothing that you think you know subjectively or experientially is absolute. It's not like you know your weight or in 1G of gravity. The mind doesn't work quite that way. What is interesting, though, is how bad can these responses be? Well, these are type 3 responders. These ones with a catastrophic response. This is an experiment where don't try this at home. We kept them awake for 88 hours, 4 days. A large cohort. This is not 5 subjects. This is 58 subjects. I'm showing you 2 examples. These are type 3 responders. as soon as they go one night without sleep, enter that night, they go to a catastrophic level of lapsing. Once you have 30 lapses, the more lapses you have, the longer they're getting. That's a very tight relationship in the way we see these. So what's going on here is you're functionally asleep. You may be awake sitting up and looking at me, but you're not processing. You're just intermittently completely out of the loop. And notice that there's some circadian modulation, but there's minimal circadian rescue. They're completely dysfunctional the rest of the way. This guy the same way. Type 2s, on the other hand, where about 60% of the population seems to be, have an effect, and they could be quite bad. Here's two examples, but they have circadian rescue the next day. That's what I refer to this as. So there, you can bring them back, at least for some portion of the day, before they have a catastrophic event again. And then type 1s just plainly are scary. And now the scale, here's 30, catastrophic, 88 hours, this guy gets one bout in it here. And this guy, I mean, the line would have to be up here. He never even gets close. In the last 40 hours of being awake, he has zero lapses. I would have said this is not possible if I had not seen it in our own hands, in our own lab. Under our controlled conditions with us drawing blood, so we know what's in his blood. We know he's not taking anything or anything. So this suggests that there are some dramatic differences, but the real acid test is, are they stable? And that led to this final slide experiment where we ran subjects through the experiments repeatedly, varied a state variable like prior sleep history, 12 versus 6 hours the week before, then put you in the lab and put you through 24 hours of deprivation. Then we do it again, and we do it again, and we vary the order, and we do the nonlinear mixed model and the interclass correlations and ask how much variance is stable trait-like, absolute. And it's 67 to 92% of the variance, which says, oh my goodness. What that means is type 3s tended to be type 3s. And type 1s tended to always be type 1s, regardless of prior history, and type 2s were type 2s. Now, there is, I don't want to make this sound too simplistic, because it turns out that the type 1s and 3s on the PVT lapsing were not necessarily those on the cognitive tasks. My colleague Hans van Dongen says, aha, it's different vulnerabilities for different functions. But before you jump to that, keep in mind that the PVT doesn't have some problems that these have. These have aptitude and learning problems, inter- and inter-subject variability, and that could easily produce high interclass correlations. If you're good at it one time, you're good at it another time. If you learn it faster than somebody else, you learn it faster than somebody else, whereas this is devoid of that, and this is the more sensitive assay. So I tend to believe that this is the correct one, but there's much more to do here. This work was made possible by lots of people. Thank you.
Okay, so just to let you remind you that tomorrow morning that David will be here again, as will be several of these people. We're going to lose Chuck Seisler tomorrow morning. So if there are any questions for Chuck or David now, and you would like to ask them, now's the time to do it.
Yes. Terry?
So is the type that you describe correlated with any other biological marker?
We have a huge target search on this. And, of course, we're also phenotyping hundreds of people we run in the lab, and we have blood and genetics, yada, yada, yada. But this question, the oldest story on prediction of response to night work or to sleep loss is the extroversion story of Isaac, that the early British studies that said extroversion, and extroverts seem to be vulnerables, type 3s. And the argument is they're out seeking sensation because they've got a low endogenous stimulation rate. They're low on, one of their monoamines is low or something. We have actually found it, and at the same correlation level that Isaac, it's nearly meaningless. It's like 0.31 or something, so it doesn't look like that's it. We've searched a lot of things, intelligence and everything else. All I can tell you is preliminarily, nothing.
So the two type 1s that you showed said African-American, is that right?
Yeah.
So is race correlated?
We run 50% African-American, 50% Caucasian. I just showed you those as examples. But that's a provocative question. And it's both males and females. I cannot tell you how strange this is when we do these experiments. I remember thinking to myself, there's two anecdotes. One is when I went into the first guy we saw like this that I really paid attention to at 88 hours. He's sitting there reading, and every day I check him, every day. There's a monitor in the room with him at all times. We can look at his data at any time. And he reports nothing, 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 nothing. Days go by. And I finally said to him, well, what are you reading? Oh, he said, I'm studying Chinese. And he clearly wasn't Asian. I said, you're studying Chinese? Yes, he says, I'm a language scholar and I'm on my seventh language. So then we thought, aha, IQ. Then the next person, though, came in. There was a Mexican-American woman, a little heavy set, had a stamp collection, but astonishing, just went right through it. And other people, you would swear, oh, they're fit, they're trained, they're dedicated, they're ex-cops or whatever. So we cannot, it's nothing, and we measure personality and all sorts of things. We cannot see anything in that. What is strange about these people is the type 1s, and which is what fascinates people, not the type 3s, although I believe actually the type 3s are more interesting. Why are they so vulnerable? But the type 1s are often not aware of it. You would think, well, they're going to be athletes because their fastest visual reaction times are sometimes 10 to 20 milliseconds faster than somebody else. That means you played a hand slap game with them, you're going to lose a lot. Okay? And they have, you'll say, do you play sports? No. Do you ever play sports? No. Anybody ever tell you you're fast? No. You know, just they have no understanding. And they don't think their responses are odd. The only thing you'll get in a group is this. We'll talk to them, the subjects, every day. They're constantly filling out forms. They're tested constantly. EEG, everything on them. Maybe the third or fourth day into it, we see them alone, and when I see one of these type, and we know they're type 1s because we now phenotype them as the data's coming out of the computer. We're tracking them day by day. We could see, oh my God, look, nothing's happening here. And so when I go to see him individually, the type 1 will say something like this. He'll say, I'll say, how are you doing? He said, fine. I said, you haven't said much when we talk to everybody together. He said, yeah, it's embarrassing. I don't experience anything those people experience. I don't know what they're talking about. Because people are saying, oh my God, I can't remember things and I can't. He says, I don't have any of that. I said, are you tired? Yes. How much sleep do you need? 7, 8 hours. But you're not getting that. I know. Are you tired? Yes. But they're on target, on task. So this is not something that seems obvious. And we've seen it for enough years that it's very, very strange. Now, on the other hand, I want to talk about a type 3, which I think I am. I was standing one night working on a grant, working on this. And I was so angry with the staff for sort of they got giddy and stupid. And about 3 a.m, I said, get the hell out of here, okay? You're all a bunch of weak, non-professional people. And I'm going to do this. So I go down, and this was years ago on the caffeine studies we're doing. So I'm sitting there typing, and I'm always measuring my own performance. So I noticed, I made a series of errors that for me are a soft neurological sign that I make. That I make these errors when I'm too tired. I said, this is stupid. I got to go down and take some caffeine. I'm writing about caffeine. So I go down and make the coffee, and I fill the carafe, and I pour it in the coffee thing, and I stick it in fresh water and all the grounds. I'm turning it on, and I'm standing back from the coffee machine on the counter thinking, you know, look at me. I'm not having any problems. Maybe this is a bad career decision. This was about 1988 or something. I said, maybe this is a bad career decision. I mean, maybe there are people who don't have a problem. Maybe I'm one of them because look at me. I'm doing fine. And then I realized I'd finished making the coffee, and I was standing in it. I had not put the carafe back in. The entire pot had run on the hot plate down on the floor. And you know, I did, instead of going home, I went back to my office absolutely delighted because I knew I was on to something here. That's it.